From PRI, Public Radio International. Welcome to Dialogue, a program that explores the world of ideas and issues in national and international affairs, history, and culture. I'm George Liston C.A. My guest today is Wilson Center Fellow Enrico Mario Santi, Professor of Spanish and Latin American Literature at Georgetown University. While at the Wilson Center, Enrico worked on an intellectual biography of Octavio Paz. Enrico, welcome back to Radio Dialogue.
Thank you. It's always good to be back.
You know, I really should probably say welcome aboard, because the last time you were here, you gave us a voyage of discovery, if I may, sir, on Octavio Paz. And I'm going to ask you to do the same today about another great Latin American voice, Pablo Neruda. Let me, to get us started, risk a perception of mine. And it owes, first of all, to some of the extraordinary confluences that we discovered between these two men. The last time we spoke, we talked of the fact that they were both, had an early departure from formal education, had diplomatic careers, Asian experience, and of course were great friends for much of Pablo Neruda's life. It's also true, and I was really struck by this, at least I think it was true, but I was certainly struck by it as I read Neruda's poetry, that there are a number of differences, obviously, and one of the ones that first sort of came home to me was that Pablo Neruda seems to me, Enrico, to be a very intuitive poet. There seems to be a great deal of emotion in Neruda's life, a great deal of passion, and in his poetry, of course. Am I on target in that perception?
You're absolutely right. In fact, I'm always struck about how we can communicate without any sort of words. Maybe we should go into show business. Because I've sometimes reflected upon how you and I can communicate in these strange ways. And on my way over here, I was thinking, well, you know, I've spoken about Octavio Paz before. What am I going to talk about now? And if I'm going to be speaking about Neruda, what should I be speaking about? Well, probably about the differences between the two guys. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that that immediately came into my mind was, well, you know, there's one obvious difference. Neruda is intuitive. Paz is intuitive, but he's also intellectual. Mm-hmm. I don't know if we made the point the last time that in Paz's poetics, Octavio Paz's poetics, what counts is not just inspiration, but also an inspiration that would be guided by reason.
Exactly, kind of Apollonian quality.
Exactly, the Apollonian guiding the Dionysiac, so to speak. Mm-hmm. Whereas in Neruda, or at least the Neruda who seems to be most successful mm-hmm. in his poetry, and I'll try to explain that in just a moment. Mm-hmm. What counts is the Dionysiac, or at least a certain Dionysiac effect. Mm-hmm. That is to say that intuition is what counts and not reason. Reason, on the contrary, is the best way for Neruda, at least, to lose touch either with reality or with the self. Uh-huh. So that intuition, passion, certainly love, would seem to be what guides the world as far as Neruda is concerned. Mm-hmm. In Paz, however, intuition and certainly passion and most definitely love are important, but they are not values in and of themselves. They cannot guide the self through history, cannot guide the self in the relationship with others, and therefore are distrusted as values in and of themselves. That is to say that passion cannot must be controlled by reason. Mm-hmm. Love has to be controlled, so to speak, by the concern for the other, by charity, let's say. And other aspects of the self, which are purely intuitive, must be controlled by some sort of a distance mm-hmm. and what one could call irony.
What I'd like to do right now is turn us back to the very origins of Pablo Neruda, both as man and poet, as much as we did with Octavio Paz. I'm struck, reading his biography, of how early the poetic impulse manifested itself in him. There's this charming vignette, if I can characterize it that way, of this small boy going off into the out into the countryside and calling himself a hunter of poems or something like that. I thought that was fascinating. Can you tell us a bit about his early life and the influences on this poetry?
Well, yes, you know, in Neruda, there is no doubt that we have someone who was who knew that he was a poet from very, very early age. Someone who was he was a very distracted boy. Someone who was always given to daydreaming, someone who would go out into the forest, the very wet forests of southern Chile, very cold and wet forests of southern Chile, hunting for insects, and then writing poems and all sorts of stories about his own adventures. We have texts of Neruda that date from when he was 8 and 9 years old. So that here is someone who was very much an intuitive child poet from his very early age.
I gather nature was an extremely important
nature
theme
was
to him.
Very is uh-huh. is a very important theme in Neruda. The contact with nature is very important, as with most modern poets, of course, and modern poetry being always a statement about immediacy, about what comes most spontaneously or naturally to us, then obviously nature has to be part of this poetics, of this outlook, of this relationship of the self to what surrounds us. And of course, the problem of the modern poet is always that. How, if you have to use language in order to talk about nature, then there's always a distance necessarily between the self and nature. So that in order for language to not to be an alienating factor, then language has to become like nature. In other words, you have to create a natural language. And Neruda was very conscious of that. But the problem with Neruda occurs very early on also, not only because of his daydreaming, so to speak, but because there was family opposition to his being a poet. Oh. That is to say, his father, who was a railroad man, very uncultured and someone who was rough and ready, someone who didn't have an education and who had a lot of many responsibilities in the family, someone who was poor also, was opposed to his being a poet. In a patriarchal culture like Latin America's patriarchal culture, to be a poet is tantamount to becoming either someone who he's on the fringes of society. Mm-hmm. Or someone whose manhood it can be readily questioned, so that the father, being extremely conscious of these things, was always protesting against Neruda writing poetry and not studying something more productive, like going into business or becoming an engineer or something that would be more acceptable within society and that would certainly resolve the economic financial problems that the family had. Therefore, from a very early age on, from the teens on, Neruda began writing poetry, but began writing poetry and texts, all sorts of texts, stories, articles, and so forth, under different pen names. So that Neruda ostensibly began to write poetry, and at the same time had to hide from his family the fact that he was a poet. And therefore we see the psychological impact that had in the choosing of a pen name, and also in leaving home when he was in his late teens and going to Santiago, where he began to study for as a professor of French. And it is as a professor of French in the Santiago of the 1920s that then he became known as a poet, and especially as a love poet.
Did the Santiago of the 1920s furnish him with anything approaching a literary circle?
The Santiago of Chile had been since the 19th century, ever since Rubén Darío, the greatest of the 19th century Parnassian poets, symbolist poets, had lived there. Since then, had been a sort of one of the literary capitals of Latin America. Mexico City was one. Buenos Aires was, of course, the capital par excellence of literary Latin America. But Santiago de Chile was also very much a bohemian, a Greenwich village of the 1920s in Latin America. Neruda became part very quickly of that group. And it is in that atmosphere that Neruda begins to cultivate all sorts of friends, literary friends, and begins to write the poetry for which he became known very early on. And especially his early poems that the one book that made him very famous early on is his one of his best known books, which is called The 20 Love Poems and a Song of Despair. 20 poemas de amor y una canción desesperada.
I'm going to ask you about those 20 love poems in just a minute, Enrico, but let me take a moment just to remind listeners everywhere that the program is Radio Dialogue. My guest today is Enrico Mario Santi, and we are talking about Pablo Neruda. Let me ask you about this early phase of Pablo Neruda, and I'd like to pose the question this way, Enrico, because you have written a marvelous study of Pablo Neruda, in which you discuss three of the most prominent aspects of the man as poet, as a visionary poet, as a man whose poetry reflected a great deal of political commentary, and then, very intriguingly, as a poet of the apocalypse. I want to talk about all those facets of him because I think they're pivotal to an understanding of him. But let me begin by asking you, first of all, were these facets distinctive or did they interweave throughout the artistic life of this this artist?
I think that, you know, to put it simply, yes, they interwove. There was a relationship constantly between, let's say, the purely visionary, what I call the purely visionary, the political and the apocalyptic. Mm-hmm. And for the convenience of the scholar, I simply made this division, mm-hmm. basing myself a little bit on the on a previous study by an American and former colleague scholar by the name of M.H. Abrams, who has written a marvelous book on romanticism, mm-hmm. on European romanticism, by the title of Natural Supernaturalism. And there, M.H. Abrams talks about the evolution, or what he perceived to be the evolution of romantic poets everywhere. Being Neruda a romantic, I immediately associated Neruda within the romantic tradition. And so my thesis was, how can we understand Neruda's relationship to the romantic tradition?
I see.
In talking about the poetics of prophecy in Neruda, this was another way of talking about the same thing. Mm-hmm. And according to Abrams, he understands it in the following way. Romantic poets have a relationship to history. That is to say, that they situate a relationship between the self and to history, which is very evident in the poets of the early 19th century in the relationship, let's say, to the French Revolution. What the French Revolution meant to romantic poets was precisely the way in which the self could find itself through revolution. That is to say, revolution meant something to that self. So that the French Revolution was really a very important event. Mm-hmm. But as the French Revolution evolved, as the French Revolution became degenerated into state terrorism or ideological terrorism, and eventually became a renewed French Empire under Napoleon, mm-hmm. of course, then the meaning of that relationship changed as well. So that from an apocalypse by revolution, that is to say that a revolution was as the central event that made the self break through alienation, then you move on to another stage that would be called apocalypse by cognition, that is to say apocalypse by a gradual withdrawal of the self and then an appreciation of nature and an appreciation of human relations. So that would be a second stage.
All right.
The third stage, however, would be a willed apocalypse inside. That is to say that all apocalypse would be something that would be internalized. Mm-hmm. Well, the only apocalypse that is possible is the apocalypse that we reach inside each and every one of us, rather than in something collective, as in the historical event, or in something willed, which would be the community relationship or the relationship to nature. Mm-hmm. So these three stages, apocalypse by revolution, apocalypse by cognition, and then apocalypse by in internalization, these three stages are what mark the different stages that I wanted to map out, so to speak, in the work of Neruda. Except in the work of Neruda, they don't happen in that chronological mm-hmm. order. They happen differently. There's a first stage, which I recognized, which was the visionary stage, which is the Neruda of residence on Earth. When Neruda goes off to Burma, when he begins to write a poetic diary, very much like Rimbaud wrote the poetic diary of A Season in Hell, in which he started to literally use poetry as a form of knowing himself and knowing what surrounded mm-hmm. him in the most basic terms. At that time, during the 1930s, of course, we know that in philosophy, a philosophy to, which was completely alien to Neruda, because Neruda, as we know, was an intuitive poet and was not a cerebral poet and not an intellectual poet at all. But we know that in philosophy, what is going on is what's called phenomenological analysis. That is to say that phenomenology is the study of things as they are in the world. And rather than speaking about great systems, what we are speaking about is how things relate to each other and how the self relates to these things. Yeah. That is to say that Neruda is pursuing really, literally, a visionary quest in his poetry, using poetry as a way of knowing what surrounds us. This is what I called the visionary stage in Neruda's poem.
Enrico, you have raised my curiosity, and I'm sure that of our listeners, to fever pitch.
Well, I don't know about that.
Would you please give us an example of some poetry from this visionary phase?
Yes. Well, precisely the poem that we have read before, the Ars Poetica, is an excellent example of this attitude of the poet, whereby he is very conscious of the situation of the poet and his relationship to reality, to what surrounds him. Between dark and the void, between virgins and garrisons, with my singular heart and my mournful conceits, for my portion, my forehead despoiled, overtaken by pallors, a grief-maddened widower's bereft of a lifetime. For every invisible drop that I taste in a stupor, alas, for each intonation I concentrate, shuddering, I keep the identical thirst of an absence, the identical chill of a fever, sounds coming to be, a devious anguish as of thieves and chimeras approaching. So in the shell of extension, profound and unaltering, demeaned as a kitchen drudge, like a bell sounding hoarsely, like a tarnishing mirror or the smell of a house's abandonment, where the guests stagger homeward, blind drunk in the night, and the reek of their clothes rises out of the floor, an absence of flowers. Could it be differently put, a little less ruefully possibly, all the truth blurted out, wind strikes at my breast like a blow, the ineffable body of night fallen into my bedroom, the roar of a morning ablaze with some sacrifice that begs my prophetical utterance mournfully, an impact of objects that call and encounter no answer, unrest without respite, an anomalous name. Ars Poetica, which is the central poem within the first book of Residence on Earth, begins by saying, and I repeat again, between dark and the void, between virgins and garrisons, with my singular heart and my mournful conceits, for my portion, my forehead despoiled, overtaken by pallors, a grief-maddened widower bereft of a lifetime. Well, it's very important to note here how the poet situates himself in space, between dark and the void, between virgins and garrisons, and then immediately goes on to define himself in a specific way, with my singular heart and my mournful conceits, for my portion, my forehead despoiled, overtaken by pallors, a grief-maddened widower bereft of a lifetime. Well, all of that self-portrait is, of course, the self-portrait of the romantic poet. Singular heart, mournful conceits, forehead despoiled, overtaken by pallors, grief-maddened widower bereft of a lifetime. Note here that not only is there a self-portrait, there's also a very ironic self-portrait. That is to say that Neruda is seeing himself as a romantic poet, but somewhat in a cliched sort of way. This is the stereotype of the romantic poet, someone who is melancholy, someone who suffers attacks, and we're going to see later on in the poem attacks of not only of visions, but things that he hears. Listen, I keep the identical thirst of an absence, the identical chill of a fever, sounds coming to be, a devious anguish as of thieves and chimeras approaching. Well, sounds in all Residence on Earth are very important, because after all, these are the sounds which will come to the poet and immediately he will translate into poetry. sounds are very important because they are the visionary equivalents of poetry. These are just like we have visions, we have auditions. Auditions in the sense of things that that the poet hears and then become part of the poetic repertoire. What I mean to say is that Neruda is here in this particular poem, it's studying not only the objects that surround him, but also the things that he hears, and trying to explain what would be the poetics that lies behind resonance.
There's a real emphasis on the sensory and the sensual.
Exactly, the sensory is very important. This is the key word. Mm-hmm. The way that the senses mm-hmm. are the ones that are used by the poet in order to produce what he is known for, namely poetry. And of course, there's this ironic restatement. Ironic because Neruda sort of laughs at himself in being the romantic poet. Reaches a point where the study of these objects can reach very degrading extremes, such as, for example, as he ends at one point in the poem. The reek of their clothes rises out of the flower, an absence of flowers. That is to say, flowers strewn on the floor, just like dirty clothes, acquire as much of an interest for the poet as, let's say, a privileged vision or a privileged sound. But in spite of the fact that this degradation occurs, in spite of the fact that there is an ironic self-portrait, and Neruda laughs at himself, he says at one point, could it be put differently, a little less ruefully, possibly? That is to say, aren't we taking this to a terrible extreme here? Am I taking myself too seriously, he says. But then he says, all the truth blurted out. Wind strikes at my breast like a blow. Well, wind striking at the poet's breast is always the sign of inspiration. That is to say, yes, it may be that this is exaggerated. It may be that this is degrading. It may be that I'm looking at myself ironically, but nevertheless, this is what I'm condemned to be. The ineffable body of night, the nighttime, which is the place of inspiration, falling into my bedroom, the roar of a morning ablaze with some sacrifice that begs, and this is the key sentence, that begs my prophetic utterance. Mournfully, and of course mournfully, because there's a struggle with death at the same time that all this is taking place. An impact of objects that call the sound that is coming to him all the time, and encounter no answer, unrest without respite, an anomalous name. And of course the anomalous name is the metaphor for the entire poem. The name is, of course, what the poet is constantly struggling towards.
Let me ask on this very juncture, that it seems to me the poet is saying that one struggles with the stuff of one's own existence, deriving that inspiration and pronouncing one's own prophecy, thereby just deriving one's own name. I mean, it's kind of an individual relation to destiny.
It's an individual relationship to destiny, but it's also an individual, in the case of Neruda specifically, notice that all of this is said within a cyclical and ironic standpoint. That is to say that there's no way you can get rid of irony.
Mm.
The poem begins by mocking the poet. And the mocking of the poet is an integral part of the poetics. The poet laughs at himself. The poet is aware that this may lead nowhere, but nevertheless, the poet is condemned to hear these sounds, to record them, and to feel bad about himself and about doing it. Nevertheless, this is the poet's lot. It's a kind of Sisyphean task that the poet has to assume heroically, so to speak.
Enrico, to conclude our conversation, I want to bring Pablo Neruda into our own time and to get your opinion on yet another aspect of him, his political life, particularly what we might call the Stalinist viewpoint that marked so much of his poetry. I guess the question is this, Enrico, in light of that kind of orthodox communist view that was so much a part of his life, can we still read Pablo Neruda today, and if so, how?
I think we can. I think we can still read Neruda, certainly not all of it, certainly not the peons to Stalin, which have proven to be not only equivocal but tragic for a poet to engage in this sort of thing. what the interesting thing is that Neruda himself recognized it. Well, as soon as 1956, Neruda recognizes that he himself had engaged in the cult of personality of Stalin. And then it is at that point that Neruda's own poetry begins to evolve. He goes back to irony. He abandons the cult of personality. He still is a communist, but he is making the distinction between communist, that is to say, political essays, a non-political poetry. That is to say, he is consciously or unconsciously arriving at the same sort of schism, the same sort of difference that Paz had already discovered and that he will fully and explicitly advocate after 1968. And in 1964, when he arrives at the ripe old age of 60, he will write a four-book autobiography that's called The Notes from Isla Negra. Isla Negra is the where Neruda had his house in Chile, where he will denounce explicitly the Stalinist period. So that yes, there is a way in which we can recognize Neruda as one of very many poets and intellectuals who were wrong. Mm-hmm. Not only were wrong, but recognized that they were wrong. Sartre is the other one. Sartre very many times defended the Soviet Union, defended Mao, defended even Pol Pot at one point, and yet retracted,
right.
Said what he was wrong, and was honest enough to pose these as defects of the intellectuals, especially European intellectuals of a certain class, who are enamored with power and with the possibilities of the intellectual mm-hmm. to and of the writer to acquire power. Neruda was no exception. I have the feeling that we can still read Neruda and the great poet that he was, even though he made these mistakes. I think the worst enemies of Neruda are the ones who would insist in not recognizing these contradictions. I think these contradictions have to be made explicit, and not only on moral grounds, but on aesthetic grounds. The poetry that the peons to Stalin are bad, not just because of the reprehensible character of Stalin, but because they are bad poetry. They don't work rhetorically. They are stiff. They are stilted. They show absolutely no respect for language. I think in that sense, I am in agreement with Paz when he says that the first thing that the poet has to show, the first thing that the writer has to show, is a respect, a love for language. And that love for language, that is to say, making words and language shine on its own rather than in subordinating it or reducing it to something else, either politics or history or home economics or whatever, this is what counts. The way that the writer has a respect for his or her own craft.
And that's what endures.
And I think that's what endures. And this is what the good, the best of Neruda shows us.
That's excellent. Enrico Mario Santi, for this introduction to Pablo Neruda, thank you so very much. And may I also say, in that marvelous answer with which we concluded our conversation, you reminded us, and I noted it down here, of the saving grace of irony, how a man can see his
that's
own
right.
errors
that's
and
right.
improve
right.
from them.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Enrico, once again.
You're very welcome.
You have been listening to Dialogue. My guest today was Enrico Mario Santi, professor of Spanish and Latin American literature at Georgetown University. I am George Liston C.A., producer and host of Dialogue. Associate producer is Mary Olive Smith. Our technical director is John Tyler. Dialogue is a production of the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. Established by Congress in 1968, the center is our nation's official and living memorial to the 28th President of the United States, Woodrow Wilson.
For a cassette copy of this program, or for more information, call the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. That's 1-800-747-7444.